Contested Heritage, Curating Our Heritage. I'm Clarissa Levy, Art and Heritage Counsel at Wedlake Bell.
And I'm Richard Hard, I'm a barrister at 39 Essex Chambers.
And I'm delighted to be joined today by Francis Fowle, Professor of 19th Century Art at the University of Edinburgh and Senior Curator at the National Gallery of Scotland and Trustee of the Burrell Collection. Francis, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, very nice to be here.
Well, those fabulous job titles always lead me to think, how did such a collection of jobs all come about and how can one person achieve all of that?
A question that a lot of my students ask me. It's a long process, but basically I developed two specialisms, I suppose, as I went along. So I not only worked peripatetically as an academic whilst my children were growing up, but I also took every opportunity to write catalogue entries for travelling shows, that kind of thing. And then eventually I got a job at Tate Britain writing online captions. And then my dream job came up. It was actually the beginning of 2000-2001 that I got a job as a provenance research curator at the National Galleries of Scotland. And then they decided to kind of work more closely on the French paintings catalogue, which became my specialism. French art really is 19th century French art is my specialism. And in the end, they advertised a joint post with the University of Edinburgh. And so that's how I come to combine teaching and research and also organising exhibitions for the National Galleries of Scotland, which I've done many of these over the years, but they've all been most enjoyable. And I'm actually working on two this year.
Two exhibitions. Well, we will come to those because how fascinating and how wonderful that to combine all of those elements of your different jobs together. So you and I met many years ago, but first worked together looking at a very specific art collection. And I wonder if you could tell us a bit about how your interest in art first developed personally from your family's history.
So it was actually my original PhD was on an art dealer called Alexander Reed. And one of the reasons why I chose that subject was because my great-grandfather was a collector and we grew up surrounded by paintings. And my father had this little stash of receipts which he kept in a briefcase under his desk, and included invoices from Alex Reed. And then when I was wandering around the Burrell collection, I became aware that Burrell also used Alex Reed as his dealer. And so I thought this might be quite an interesting subject for a PhD. So I looked more into my grandfather as a collector, and I discovered that actually he had quite a significant collection of over 300 pictures, paintings. And in fact, he published a catalogue in 1904. And looking through it today, you realise that actually quite a number of the old masters were duds, but he had some good ones too. For example, the Vermeer Christ in the House of Mary and Martha, which actually my grandfather and great uncle donated to the National Galleries of Scotland, much to my chagrin. And then also he specialised really in 19th century art and under the influence of Alex Reed. He had a really important collection of French 19th century art, and he developed passions for certain artists. So for example, he had 20 works by Camille Corot, but he also had over 30 works by Adolf Monticelli, who's a very obscure artist that no one has heard of today, but everyone associates me with Monticelli because he actually was the artist that Van Gogh greatly admired, but now everyone thinks he's terrible. But then the other aspect of his collecting was Scottish painting, contemporary art. And well, in fact, he first developed an interest in the Glasgow Boys through Alex Reed, and began collecting the work of Joseph Crawhall. And then he switched to another dealer, W.B. Patterson, who was the brother of James Patterson, another of the Glasgow Boys. And so he kind of continued that passion, and he ended up acquiring 45 works by Crawhall. So he was definitely his favourite artist, I think.
The title of this episode, Curating Our Heritage, it goes towards what I find such a fascinating question of how not just fashions come and go. And as you said, some of the paintings in your grandfather's collection, your great-grandfather's collection, are now not considered so wonderful as others. But this collection of Crawhall pictures in particular, presumably at the time of collection, wasn't considered quite so sort of important for our heritage as Crawhall pictures have come to be seen now. And that's really the subject that I find so interesting, because you were faced with some decisions, you and your brothers were faced with some decisions about what to do with your family's collection in 2020 after your mother had passed away.
Yeah, so I mean, the collection was dispersed over the years. After my great-grandfather died, it was left to my grandfather and great-uncle. And in fact, the picture we were going to talk about was actually left to my great-uncle. And then my grandfather bought it back after my uncle died, but it remained in the family. And by the time my mother died, my father died in 2009 and my mother died in 2020. So by the time she died, there were only 7 works, I think, crawls left in the collection on our side of the family. They've been kind of dispersed elsewhere, either sold off or had gone to my cousins.
So you had 7 left?
So we had 7 left, which is a bit of a shame, really. But they still hung in the drawing room when I was growing up, which is nice.
And so you were faced with the decision of what to do in your mother's estate. And one of the decisions that you were considering was whether and how to make an offer in lieu of tax. So just to explain for people who are not aware of that scheme, offers in lieu of tax are, it's known as the AIL scheme, the acceptance in lieu scheme. And basically, it's when you give a preeminent object, such as an important painting, to the nation in payment of an inheritance tax liability. And so that was something that you were considering doing. And the first painting that you were considering making an offer in lieu of tax wasn't one of the Crawhall pictures, but your Calf picture.
Yes, we had this very large Calf still life, which used to hang in the hall in our house. My mother rather liked it, and my father less so, probably. But anyway, so we decided, I think we sold the collection that remained through Sotheby's. One of my brothers lives in America, so we weren't really in a position to keep them all, although I was very keen to keep a number. And anyway, we decided that Sotheby's advised us that painting would be a good one to offer through the acceptance in lieu scheme. But there had historically been doubt over its attribution, although that had been then kind of set aside through further research. But when we kind of looked into it, it just seemed too problematic to put forward for the AIL. We had discussions with National Galleries, but they were unable to take it because of this problem. So we put it into auction. But then in the meantime, Sotheby's said, well, if you're going to put it into auction, I think you should get some conservation work done on it because it could do with a bit of a cleanup. So we paid really not very much at all to have this conservation work done. And it completely transformed the painting. It was quite amazing, really, the difference. And then it was put into auction. And miraculously, I watched it online. It was terribly exciting because some pictures in that sale didn't sell at all. And then somehow this work caught the imagination of 2 bidders. And it kept going up and up, and it eventually went for, I think it was 3 times the original inheritance tax value. So yeah. It was great.
Wow. Mm. I remember it well, and I remember thinking how fascinating the journey of this painting just in this moment where it might have been offered to the nation in lieu of tax, but it couldn't be because no one knew whether it was the right thing and whether it was preeminent. And you sort of sounded the nation out, as it were, do you want it? And the answer was no. And then it went on to sell so incredibly successfully for 3 times what it had been thought to be worth previously. So that's a really interesting, I mean, it's an excellent result, obviously, for the family and the collection. And by the same token, then, there was a very interesting sort of journey with the collection of 7 Crawhall paintings. So can you tell us a bit about what happened there?
So the thing that was wonderful about the Calf was it was in a live sale. Everyone was in the auction room and there was such a tremendous atmosphere. And I always think that sales go rather well when you've got that atmosphere brewing. And then with the Crawhalls, they were going to include them in a Scottish sale. And then they decided, for some reason, to put them into a mixed sale, British and Irish art, online. And I thought at the time, ooh, I'm not sure if that's going to be a terribly good decision. And actually, it was quite disappointing for us. And before the sale, I decided to keep back 1, and then there was another which had condition problems. So they advised us only to put 5 of the pictures into the sale. And of those 5, only 1 sold well, which was one that we'd expected to do well. 2 went for their reserve price, so below the bottom estimate, and 2 failed to sell. And I think it was just, if one had put the clock back a few years, some of these pictures were selling for really impressive sums, but for some reason, Crawhall's kind of gone off everyone's radar temporarily. So it just was rather disappointing.
And this brings us back really interestingly to the acceptance in lieu scheme, because as you say, 2 of the Crawhall pictures didn't sell at all. So that's not good news, really, in terms of pictures which you might be considering offering to the nation. It's not a tool commonly followed path that you would try and sell something at auction publicly, and then if it doesn't sell, then offer it to the nation. That's not at all the normal journey. Because normally, if an object is preeminent, you know it straight away, you can offer it straight away, and there's no question of trying a public sale first. But in this particular instance, thinking about the painting of the cock pheasant, would you like to describe what happened there?
Yes, so this is rather a wonderful painting, actually. There were kind of three works in the collection that we'd retained, which I always felt would do well. One was The Tiger, which did sell. One was a painting of a mallard rising up from a lake, which I was incredibly fond of and was really disappointed when it went for a kind of slightly disappointing price. And then the third was The Cock Pheasant, which is this rather quirky painting. I mean, Kuhl is, he's absolutely brilliant. He specialises in painting in gouache on Holland linen, and all these pictures were in that medium. So it's not a traditional painting of a pheasant. The pheasant has character, and he paints with tremendous panache. He's painting this wonderful kind of impressionistic way, quite sparingly, in fact. He was also really interested in Chinese and Japanese painting. So it has this highly decorative feel to it and a kind of Japanese element, especially it has these wonderful berries on the right-hand side. It's a beautiful painting. So it was really sad when it didn't sell.
But then, as you say, it's an incredibly charming picture of a pheasant, really charming. And what was interesting there was that the National Gallery of Scotland had indeed noticed that the painting hadn't sold and said, unusually, would it still be possible for this painting, even though it has been unsold at auction, it's still an important painting and we'd still absolutely love to have it. So could it still be offered in lieu of tax? And that was such a fascinating approach because, again, most unusual, but beautifully, it was possible to do that. And you and your brothers were indeed able to say, yes, it can be. Since it didn't sell, absolutely, of course it can be. It's still preeminent. It's still the painting that it was. It just so happens that in that moment, in that auction, it didn't find a buyer. But that doesn't change the fact of the painting's importance. So long story short, the painting now hangs at the Scottish National Gallery. And the outcome was absolutely more successful, I would say, for the estate than had the auction sale completed. So really interesting comparison with the Calf.
And actually, one of the things was my brother was quite concerned, my brother in Scotland was quite concerned that it would slow down the whole process of winding up the estate. So we had a kind of deadline to complete. And it actually was completed by that deadline, which was really efficient. And there are still some loose ends to tie up, I have to say. So it wasn't the AIL process which slowed it down. It was other things. So yeah, it was very satisfactory. And I was thrilled to see it in the National Galleries. I obviously wasn't able to take any part in this because I am a curator there. So it was a slightly odd situation to be in. And then the other delightful outcome was that the Mallard Rising ended up in the Burrell collection. And that again was slightly frustrating because I'm a trustee. We weren't able to bid for it at auction. So again, I couldn't take any part in the decision to acquire it, but it was actually bought by a dealer and eventually the trustees, they were able to buy it back. And that, so now two of the pictures are in Scottish public collections. And I feel that's just tremendous because it means that so many more people will be able to see it from day to day. Obviously, because they're in gouache, they'll have to be in storage because of the light levels. But people, if they want to go and see them, they can ring up and they can make an appointment and see them in the print room or wherever. So yeah, it's a wonderful outcome.
Well, if I may say, as you say, offers in lieu of tax can be done most efficiently in the right hands. Yeah. Such a successful outcome and completely the opposite to what one would have expected. Because normally when you're looking at the sort of strategy of an art collection and what can be offered in lieu of tax if there is an inheritance tax liability and what should be sold at auction, if anything, this was really a sort of reversal of what might have been expected and yet couldn't have been more successful in the end. So the right result was absolutely achieved.
I just raise a question, how we judge preeminence, not by market value, but how do you think that through in terms of, is this a suitable object for the acceptance in lieu scheme?
I think that's a good question. I think Clarissa is better at answering that than I am.
Well, I'm throwing that to both of you.
Well, I've given this a lot of thought over the years, as have very many greater minds than mine. And I mean, I do find it endlessly fascinating what constitutes our national heritage and what doesn't. I'm constantly surprised and delighted by the new things which crop up, given in lieu of tax, and therefore then are given the stamp of approval and are part of our national heritage now. And it's always new things. So it can be not just important works of art, but it can be all sorts of cultural objects. I was involved in the offer in lieu of a Welsh slate mine locomotive. I've recently been discussing objects as diverse as tractors and Spitfires, you know, objects don't have to be old master paintings. And as we saw in the case of the cock pheasant, just because an object isn't tremendously commercial certainly doesn't mean that it's not of interest for us all to see as part of the national collection. So really, it's, I think our culture is whatever we choose it to be. Frances, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I'm trying to think of cases that I've been involved in at the National Galleries. And the most recent one before that, actually, following up, was it was a little Monet pastel. So it's important from the point of view of the galleries themselves of our public institutions that it can help to fill gaps in the collection. And this pastel, even though it seems kind of modest little work, it represented a period. It's a pastel of the dramatic rock formations at Etretat on the Normandy coast. And we had nothing like that in the collection at all. Even though we have got six works by Monet, they all represent different periods and not that period. It was a kind of crucial gap. So that was really wonderful to receive that. And also it had Scottish provenance. It's important, really, that these things have Scottish provenance. There was another one, actually, funny enough, I was involved in, which was wearing my two hats. There was conflict. And actually, it was offered to Glasgow museums. And we really wanted it for the Borough Collection. But the Borough Collection can't accept anything like that because it's a closed collection. We can buy things, but we can't accept gifts. So in the end, it went to Kelvin Grove Art Gallery. It was a wonderful Mie pastel. But I would have loved that for the National Galleries because we have, well, until very recently, we had no examples of, no Mie paintings and certainly nothing. I mean, this is a pastel, but it was nothing as important or on such a kind of scale as this work. And yet we weren't in a position to take it because the person that was offering work, and you can specify which museum you offer it to or which geographical region you want to offer it to, which is another thing I think people perhaps don't realise.
There are many nuances to the tax incentives that we have in this country for preserving our national heritage, which it constantly, as I learn more about them, they surprise me again and again with just how cleverly thought through they are and how imaginative the schemes are in really protecting our heritage in ways that you think, how could they have imagined this? And really, when I'm thinking about what will constitute a work of art or an object that's important enough to be protected and benefit from these tax incentives, to let you into my head, I use just very basic shorthand. And I just think, is it important? If an object is important, culturally important to me or to someone, then chances are it'll be possible to argue that it is preeminent. That's how it works in my head anyway.
It is interesting though, because actually in the case of our collection when we inherited it, there were certain items which we all always understood were preeminent. And that was kind of through the years. And then we had to get them all re-evaluated by Sotheby's. So you kind of have to start from scratch in a way when you inherit an estate. You can't kind of make assumptions about what is and what isn't. And somebody has to make that decision at some point. And I'm always slightly hazy about who does make the decision. I think you have to take the guidance of, if you approach someone like Sotheby's or Christie's, that they can guide you. Or someone like you, Clarissa, I suppose.
Well, thank you so much. What happened here in this particular case, it's often not just down to one person or one institution that's deciding. It's actually always a conversation, isn't it? And in this case, you know, it was the National Gallery of Scotland that actually approached me and said, I saw your painting, this painting didn't sell. Do you think it might be possible for you to see if it can be offered in lieu of tax? And that is what I think is so, so clever and thoughtful about the way it all works, is that you weren't just then relying on the advice of one person or one auction house. It's actually coming from the institutional side. And we're being advised that if a gallery is interested in hanging a picture on its walls, well, then it is important. And the chances are it will be agreed by the AIL panel of Arts Council that the object is preeminent. And so it proved.
Yeah. And perhaps the other topic this particular case throws up is how you value the art for acceptance in lieu in circumstances where, in fact, it didn't actually manage to sell when it was being auctioned. So there isn't a sort of market tested in the sense of an auction price that's been reached for it.
So this is the problem, because so with the cock pheasant, we took the original IHT valuation, I think, inheritance tax valuation. But then if we'd done the same with the calf and put it through the AIL process, we'd have actually, you know, financially been worse off. So it's kind of swings and roundabouts, isn't it?
Exactly. So two questions here, and fascinating ones. I think value is so interesting. with the Calf, exactly as you say, Francis, had it been offered in lieu, it would have ended up being given to the nation at a third of its actual value. And no one would have really ever known that, because the point about offering an object to the nation is it hasn't been sold publicly, so you never test the market. And you really just have to do your best job at deciding and justifying what the value of the object is. But you're doing that kind of, it's your best guess always. And it's the best guess of many experts. It's incredibly carefully looked at by all sides so that a fair and just result is reached. But, you know, but still, anything can happen, as was proved when the Calf actually did sell for three times what anyone supposed possibly could. And it's a very interesting question about what you do when something has been put up for sale at auction estimates, which are, in everyone's opinion, the correct auction estimates, but just as it happens on that day, hasn't found a buyer. Well, then what you do, and what was done in this case, is you take it down, take the value down by what's known in the biz as a notch. So it was sold at X to Y auction estimates. And when it was offered in lieu, it hadn't sold for the low estimate of X. So, you know, a small deduction from that was made. And then we said, well, look, actually, this value isn't wrong. Just because it didn't find a buyer doesn't mean it's worth tremendously less than this. On the contrary, it's an important painting as it ever was. And the nation accepted that. So it was offered in lieu at just under its auction estimates. And with the tax incentive that is allowed for offers in lieu of tax, it turned out that the financial result actually for the estate was really good. And in fact, better than if it had sold on its reserve at auction. There's a really interesting question about what happens with value. And for that reason, such a great result for the estate.
Yeah. And I think the other thing to bear in mind is that if you do put a work into auction, you have to pay a vendor's premium and you'll also have to pay additional capital gains tax potentially. So you have to kind of factor that in as well.
Yes, indeed. It is not free to sell things.
I think the other thing, Clarissa, that you might explain, because we always found it quite difficult to get our heads around this idea of the douceur, just to explain to perhaps the people listening.
Yes. So the douceur is the tax incentive which is applied to the gift of an object under the acceptance in lieu scheme. Douceur means sweetener. And yes, it's the incentive that we're given to offer objects in lieu of tax rather than sell them to raise money and pay the tax that way. So when you're giving an object under the AIL scheme, you receive in exchange a tax credit which you set against your inheritance tax liability. And you won't pay tax in the normal way on a disposal under the AIL scheme. Instead, they deduct the tax that you would normally have to pay from your tax credit, and they add back on a portion of it, which is the incentive, that's the douceur. So it amounts to your tax credit being a greater amount than what you would receive if you sold the object publicly in net cash proceeds. And as you say, Francis, two of the Kruhl pictures then ended up in public collections, which brings us neatly back to one aspect of your amazing job, which is, of course, to organise exhibitions. And you mentioned at the beginning of our discussion that you've got two exhibitions coming up. Would you like to tell us about those?
I'd love to, yeah. So I've got one that just opened at the Burrell Collection. My specialism is, I think I mentioned at the beginning, is 19th century French art and collecting, and actually the art market itself. So this exhibition is on Edgar Degas, the Impressionist artist, but more specifically on a taste for Degas in Britain. And of course, the Burrell is a fitting place to hold that exhibition because there are 22 works by Degas in the permanent collection there. It's the biggest UK collection of his work. So that's open now and it'll be open to the end, I think it's about 24th of September. And then the other one that I'm working on, which will open at the end of July, 20th of July, roughly, is on the Irish artist, John Lavery, who was one of the Glasgow boys. And it's called An Irish Impressionist, Lavery on Location. It's about Lavery's, he's best known as a portrait painter, but this actually focuses on him as a travelling artist, travelling from place to place and painting. It's actually rather wonderful. If you want a bit of escapism, if you want to have a taste of the Mediterranean and North Africa and the Alps and even Scotland, then come and see that.
Well, I personally can't wait and will be there next week. Much looking forward to it, Francis.
Brilliant.
Francis, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Art and Heritage Law Contested Heritage. Please do follow or subscribe on Apple or Spotify podcasts to enjoy more shows.
We have a new podcast out every fortnight. If you're able, please take the time to rate us and put down a review.
The show is also on the 39 Essex Chambers website, along with podcast series on topics such as artificial intelligence, climate change, and planning.